Fare you well, my honey. Fare you well, my only true one. All the birds that were singing are flown, except you alone. Gonna leave this broke down palace on my hands and my knees. I will roll, roll, roll. Make myself a bed by the water side. In my time, I will roll, roll, roll. In a bed by the waterside, I will lay my head, listen to the river sing sweet song to rock my soul. River gonna take me, sing me sweet and sleepy, sing me sweet and sleepy all the way back home. It's a far gone lullaby sung many years ago. Mama, mama, many worlds I've come since I first left home. Going home by the waterside, I will rest my bones, listen to the river sing sweet songs to rock my soul. Going to plant a weeping willow on the bank's green edge. It will grow, grow, grow. Singing a lullaby beside the water. Lovers come and go. The river will roll, roll, roll. Fare you well, I love you more than words can tell. Listen to the river sing sweet songs to rock my soul. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio. They deserve your support. Two streams of music, just about 24/7. Be sure to head over to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com and show them some love. Find that donation button. Or find one of their products. But one way or another, help them out. They really deserve it. That first song was Broke Down Palace, written by Robert Hunter, longtime lyricist for the Grateful Dead, who died early this week. And he was just an amazing lyricist. Wrote songs for the dead, but also for many others, including even Bob Dylan. And Bob doesn't let other people write his lyrics very often. So that was our first big loss of the week. And the second one, just yesterday, Mike Ringley, the better known as Nighthawk, the owner of Revolution Radio, passed away early yesterday morning. And I'll tell you, Mike leaves behind an incredible legacy. This station, which we are all going to try to keep going in his memory and as his legacy. And it's a pretty darn good one. He was really a great guy. I never got to meet him in person, but in the times that I did speak to him, he seemed like a very caring and a loving person. And he really cared about the idea of free speech and of letting everyone have a platform for their ideas, to talk about their ideas and get them out to the public. And as I say, it is listener-supported radio. I know that Liz, his wife, would probably appreciate any donations that came in about now. After all, there's lots of extra expenses, funeral expenses, and so forth. My heart and my prayers go out to her. And hey, Hawk, we're going to miss you. We really are. All right, well, now we're going to proceed with our first guest, and I'm going to introduce her on the recording. So here we go. Well, our first guest of the evening tonight will be Deb Cullen Smith. Deb is an author and a friend, and CWG Press, my publishing company, is in the process of putting out the third volume of her trilogy, The Last of the Long-Haired Hippies. Deb, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Why don't you start off by telling people a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you, Chuck. I'm a grandmother of 12. I guess that's probably my biggest accomplishment in life. And the mother of four dogs, pack leader, I should say, to four dogs. So yes, it's, and four of the grandchildren live with me. So this is a very rowdy house. This is not a calm house, which is why I use headphones a lot whenever I'm writing, and why the dad in the family has complained about my rock music, because of course I did a lot of Janis Joplin and a lot of Jefferson Airplane and Carlos Santana while I was writing Last of the Long-Haired Hippies. Yeah, so we had to have mood music. So he has issued a couple of complaints about the level of the volume of my music while I was writing. But you know, you got to drown out four dogs and four kids, ages 12 all the way down to four. So that gets interesting. That is a monumental task just in itself. Yeah, go ahead.
How long have you been working on this particular project?
Well, Chuck, this one has been probably the longest thing I have ever accomplished, which is why it feels so good to be on the finish line with it. I've been working on this one for about 20 years.
Wow.
I had the idea. I just didn't know where to go with it. And I've let it stew and I've let it simmer. But I've been going to conferences. I'll put in for makers right about here. If you write science fiction and fantasy, this is the one conference you want to go to every year, because it is phenomenal. It is the Science Fiction Fantasy Tribe for Christian writers. And after going to about 7 years worth of Realm Makers conferences about 2 years ago, I came home pretty much having a few more ideas about where this story could head. And I sat down and graphed it all out, and it took up, with index cards, it took up my entire dining room table with the leaf in. And yeah, and then I just stacked all those up and I started writing. And it was amazing. I mean, I've had, you know, 2 and 3 chapters written for a long time, but I finally had the structure and I knew approximately where the story was going. Now, I will also add at this point, my characters do not always agree with me. They often fight with me, and in the end they win because they just refuse to do what I want them to do. So, yeah, when the voices in your head fight back, that should be the name of the next book.
All right. Well, it's always fascinating to me to talk to different writers and hear the different ways that they do it. I mean, there are some people that just sit down and write. No outline, nothing but some idea that just popped into their head and boom, they're done. And like, wow, how do they do that?
I don't understand it.
Yeah, I know.
I don't understand that. I tried that for about 15 years. I tried that. It didn't work.
Okay, well. But you certainly found something that worked, because the result is phenomenal. I am very proud to be publishing this work. Why don't we tell the listeners a little bit about the story?
In book one, Victoria Barton is a 40-year-old woman, still a little bit haunted by her youth, and you don't realize how haunted until you actually hear what her youth was like. Once you get through book two, you pretty much will go, well, I would be a basket case too if I went through everything she went through. Yeah. But she works in a bookstore, and she has a mystery guest coming in from New York City for a book signing, and she doesn't know this guy, but she got a call from his agent saying, you know, we really want to come. My author really wants to come and do this signing in your bookstore. And it's a small little town in the middle of southern Illinois. So, you know, nothing really, it's not a big venue. But she takes the booking, and things are just not adding up. And some things start going wrong in the town. A little boy's dog is viciously murdered and done in a very sacrificial way. And then a woman is attacked very viciously. And then Victoria starts getting very strange phone calls. And at this point, her friend slash boyfriend slash becomes her fiancé decides to get her out of Dodge. So they try and get out of town, but trouble follows them all the way to St. Louis. And there's a lot of local color in this, so anybody that's been in the St. Louis area will recognize a few places, or may recognize a few places at any rate. So it was fun to write that part. Victoria, when she realizes that they're being followed even in St. Louis, they head back to their hometown, and she has found out by this point that the author coming in is her old boyfriend, and her old boyfriend is someone that she ran away with at 16 back in 1968, and they lived with the hippies in San Francisco for a year. And then they ended up at Woodstock, and it's a very in-depth look at Woodstock, the good and the bad. This is not meant to be a criticism of the hippies. I would have been there, too, if I hadn't been 13 years old. If I had been just a couple years older, my mother would have, I'm sure, been reporting a runaway daughter, because I would have joined in vigorously. So it's kind of a story that I could relate to, and I really wanted a more positive spin on the lifestyle of the hippies. Not that everything they did was right. I don't agree with a lot of it. You don't just love the one you're with. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with that type of ideology. But they were set on trying to do something to change the world, and it was such a tumultuous time in this country. And I was old enough at least to know that. And my dad was in Vietnam in 1969, so freaking time. So there's a lot of that period that I have very clear memories of and some scared feelings about. So I tried to bring a lot of that out. And the hippies wanted to bring about change. I think in some ways they did. In a lot of ways they failed. But I think that the main reason they failed was that they left God out of the equation. And that's the conclusion that Victoria comes to as well. Now, by the time I was old enough, I hit the sweet spot just as the Jesus people were coming more into prominence. And that was where I ended up belonging. So I have a real affinity for those who came out of the counterculture and went straight into the Jesus people and knew that it's only by God, by God's love for this world, that we can affect any kind of change. We aren't going to do it by marching. We're not going to do it with guns. It's got to be by the Holy Spirit or we're doomed to fail. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where the story ended up heading. And I did not even see the end coming on this one. It did change a couple of times. My villain changed two or three times. Yeah, it was quite an interesting, and then as you know, the Victoria's War, book three, changed pretty drastically from when you first saw it. There were some pretty major battle differences by the time I was finished writing. And I didn't see those coming from a mile off.
Yeah, right. Well, it just kept getting better.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm just tickled that we really got together on this because you're kind of my idea of a hippie anyway.
I'll take that as
a compliment. I knew you had the heart for it.
So I'm a hippie that ended up on the vestry at my church. So, you know, I'm kind of the God, you know,
Yes, exactly. My point exactly. You just made it.
All right, good. Deb, have you ever worked in a bookstore?
No, I have not. I always figured if I went to work in a bookstore, I would never bring home a paycheck.
That sounds right. Okay.
Well, it would just be too dangerous.
Your writing about it seemed so accurate that I just had to ask that.
Now whenever I was, I guess in high school, I did help set up some libraries in poorer communities in our area. That was up more around Kankakee. And just south of Chicago, and so I did know how to catalog books and alphabetize them, and I have a minor library in my own house. It's actually probably a fairly major library in my own house because I hardly ever get rid of books. I just keep getting more. So you know, I am the firm believer in just because you run out of bookshelves doesn't mean you stop buying books. So I have them stacked everywhere. So yeah, I am a big lover of books and always have been all my life. So I have my own small library here. So I would be comfortable working in a bookstore. That would be totally within my comfort zone. I could live in a bookstore.
Probably, but too comfortable. But
probably. It just would not be good. Sorry, I can't pay the house payment this month, but you know they had this really awesome sale, and I just blew my paycheck.
Oh, well.
Somehow that wouldn't go over well. So.
Right.
I just know myself well enough to know that's not a good idea.
Right. Thank you.
freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Testing.
Hey.
Testing. Hello. Good evening, working stiffs. deliver us from evils. To this writer, there are in reality but two classifications of evil people. A, the crazed or deranged evil ones, and B, the rational, without empathy or caring, evil ones. I just viewed Alan Parker's great 2000 film, Angela's Ashes, for perhaps the upteenth time. The film is based upon Frank McCourt's autobiography on growing up in Limerick, Ireland, during the 1930s and 1940s. His family was extremely poor during that Depression era, as more of his younger siblings died than lived. What got to this writer were the places that the McCourts had to live in during these hard times. Dirty, dank, leaky, vermin-infested spaces that one would never even ask a pet to live in. The continuous Limerick rain would settle in the alley and on the main stone floors of their place. All the absentee landlord, an Irishman, like his tenants, cared about was getting his rent, or out they would go. Never to upgrade or even repair the dwellings that he made his money from. When the McCourts got behind by a month or two in their rental payments, out they would go. Well, that type of person is the Part B classification, rational, free of empathy, evil. We all see the stories of crazed gunmen just unloading on passers-by with an automatic killing machine that should never have been sold in the first place. Many of those gunmen are most likely insane or at least terribly emotionally disturbed individuals, thus my Part A classification. The Part B, rational without empathy, evil ones, are most likely both the gun manufacturers and the gun retailers who continue to make and sell those WMDs. One does not need to hunt for deer with an AK-47, period. There is no sport in the pleasure shooting with an AK-47. Now here comes the topper. What about those in government who defend the rights of gun manufacturers and gun retailers to ply their trade? Well, it doesn't matter about the legalities of operating in what cash can shoot as an evil. The aforementioned landlord not get laws to operate outside of laws of that time. Yet, there must be an accountability or on moral or humane grounds for how he conducted himself. We should take that to the philosophical and spiritual limit and begin categorizing those who know better yet still defend the acts of other evil ones. Case in point, the invasion of Iraq. Anyone, and I mean anyone, who knew that the Bush-Cheney cabal's information on WMDs by Iraq was false and highly misleading and did nothing about it at the time is evil, period. Anyone in government or the embedded media who finds out that those who lead us have perpetrated a crime and says nothing, evil. There was a guy I knew who seemed like a nice and decent man. I recall a few years ago when he was telling me about a telemarketing job he had. He laughed and told me that he worked for a guy who said he was in real estate. The employer had him cold call lists of people who had their homes up for sale. The pitch was to get them to list their homes on his new website that reached millions of prospective home buyers from actual real estate broker lists nationwide. He mailed them a brochure that explained things with beautiful graphics. Then he would call back a few days later and close them out on a $75 fee to be placed on the new site. Well, the skinny of it all was that there was no new website. If anyone complained, they were told that the site was being constructed shortly. By the time the new sucker realized it was not happening, they had already sold their home and moved on. Two evil people, the employer and the guy I knew. Perhaps if those amongst us who are not in either category, but still won't get pissed off until some evil touches them or their families, remember the quote from Edmund Burke. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Thank you.
Well, that was a very powerful piece, and we now have Philip with us live on the show.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Now, Philip, one thing that kind of bothers me with what you were saying, you draw such a definite line between people who are good and people who are evil, and I'm just not convinced that anybody is like either all good or all evil. There is such a people are so complicated that I'm not sure anybody really fits on one side or the other.
Well, we all have free will that God gave us, and there are people. Let's face the facts. Adolf Hitler loved little children and dogs, but he was one of the most evil men that ever walked the face of the earth. So, you know, a person, to answer your question, a person could be a kind-hearted individual, give money to charities, but yet, like that absentee landlord in the film or the book, Angela's Ashes, that absentee landlord, the way he behaved towards the tenants, he was evil. He had no compassion. He had no understanding. He didn't care. He just wanted his money. He didn't care how they lived. And that's the real clinker here, because, as you said, no one is necessarily in general. No one is 100% evil or 100% good. But we have free will, and we make the decisions according to what we want to do. And if someone makes a decision to do an evil act or to be quiet and to keep silent when those around him or her are doing terribly evil acts, then the evil has to rub off on them. I mean, that's the only way you can look at it, Chuck.
Well, that's it. Suppose you see something that is horrible, and you know who did it, and you have the possibility of reporting them to the authorities, but you know at the same time it was a really powerful person. They probably have bought off just about all of the authorities, and if you make this report, you're probably going to get dead. Mightn't you be so afraid that you can't do it? And if that happens, are you still evil for not doing
it? In those cases, in those instances, people can drop a dime anonymously if they have to because of the fear. So I can understand that. And I'm not judging someone who is in the hypothetical circumstance, because I can empathize with someone who is in that circumstance. But you still can do something anonymously, at least to alert the public at large that this is going on, and to remain totally silent. I remember one time I was teaching in a high school back in Queens, New York, in 1986. I was teaching a health ed course. And that was a time when crack was really, really prevalent. And I was in a school that was in a very low-income area of Queens, and most of the students were from low-income families. And I asked the kids one day, I said, "How do you feel about crack?" And the kids in my class, "Oh, it's bad, you know." And I said, "Well, let me ask you a question. What if your neighbor was selling crack out of his house, and you knew about it, and you didn't want to drop a dime on him? Would you drop a dime on your neighbor, even anonymously?" "No, no, that's being a rat. That's being a rat." "Okay, what if your neighbor was selling crack to your younger sister or brother?" "Oh, man, I'd kill him." I go, "Oh, okay. So if it has to do with your family or your loved ones, then you would jump in. Then you would jump in, right? If that was the case. But if that's not the case, then you wouldn't do it." You know what I'm saying? So the kids were very, very puzzled at my analogy, because they really understood that, you know, to remain silent when there's evil, and selling crack, was evil. It was an evil act, because you were screwing people up. You were screwing up their bodies, their lives. So, again, all I can suggest, Chuck, is if we remain silent when we're in the presence of evil actions by people, it's to me, you're an accessory after the fact. That's how I feel.
Okay. Well, in your analogy, I would contend that someone who is selling crack to people who were already addicted to crack was not really performing such an evil act. Now, if someone who was selling crack to school kids that had never been exposed to any drugs and trying to get them hooked, yeah, that's awful. This is similar. Do you remember the Steppenwolf song, "The Pusher"?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's kind of the difference between the dealer and the pusher. The dealer really is not inherently evil, whereas the pusher Yeah, that's evil. You're getting people started on something. You're taking away their normal life and, you know, putting them on a different path.
Okay, but you know, the fact remains that we are our brother's keeper, aren't we? That's what they say in the Bible, right? But we're our brother's keeper.
Well,
and if you, I mean, I remember my son once. He was in high school. He was 16, and he was telling me that a friend of his was making a lot of money selling steroids, you know, to weightlifters and stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, "No, that's terrible." And his answer to me was, "Well, you know, people want it, so, and they're going to get it anyway, so, you know, why shouldn't you make a few dollars on it?" Well, that's the whole point, you know. If you don't have a moral compass, then there can be a lot of problems. And that's why I believe that we as citizens of the world should be more in tune with things that are being done that I would construe as being evil, you know?
Yeah. Well, I can certainly, you know, agree that we need to be aware of things that are evil. It's just that you say we're our brother's keeper, and certainly that's good, but does that mean we're our brother's watchdog as well? Are we supposed to watch all of our neighbors diligently and turn them into the government for anything that we might think is wrong?
You're a libertarian, Chuck, aren't you?
Well,
you're a libertarian. Okay.
I'm probably more of an anarchist, Phil.
Okay, you're an anarcho. You're an anarcho libertarian. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I'm talking about evil. You know, evil is not. I mean, if some guy is well, it's evil. Let's say a guy is overselling people at a new car business. He's taking advantage of the customer. That's an evil act, you know. But it's not an evil act like, selling somebody a drug that's going to kill them. But it's still, to me, I classify that as an evil act. That's how I see things, you know. I mean, I think if more of us would see things with a finer tooth comb, I think maybe this would be a better place to live. If we continue to overlook, you know.
Okay, I just feel as though you are too much on the judgmental side here. I'm non-judgmental as much as I can possibly be. There are things that I will not accept, but in most cases, there might be something that I don't like, but I'm not. I don't necessarily want to stand in judgment. That's God's place to be in the judgment.
Okay, that's a point well taken. I mean, let me give you an example. Do you think would you consider it, let's say you needed a certain medication, right, for a really serious condition, and your insurance didn't cover it? I mean, I had a friend of mine that had he wound up having Lou Gehrig. He died from Lou Gehrig's disease.
Uh-huh.
And you know, near the end, the last year when he was ill, the medication he needed was like ridiculous. It was like $500 a month or $800 a month for the medication. And you know, and to me, that company is evil. To charge that much money to people that are ill, I mean, the medication was for people that are very ill.
Yeah.
You know, and if we live in a society where capital gain is the most important thing, the so-called, you know, marketplace, which is not a marketplace, because if it was a real marketplace with real competition, maybe that drug would be a lot less, you know, maybe it'd be
exactly.
one-tenth the price.
Yeah.
Okay, but the point I'm making is that, isn't that evil? Isn't that company evil that would charge that much, knowing that people need that in order to actually live, and if they can't afford it? I mean, you have to draw the line, right? I mean, the line in the sand, you know? And it's the same with the gun manufacturers, in my piece. I mean, you know, really, you got these people going out and buying these you know, automatic AK-47, and a lot of them are doing things with these you know, weapons. And I mean, where's the responsibility? You know, in other words, if you have a system where, well, it's legal, so they can sell it, and anybody wants to buy it, and I mean, to me, there's something lacking here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, let me ask you this, Bill. Should the police be allowed to have those weapons?
I have to think about that. I don't know if a cop needs an AK-47. I mean, they have weapons that are very efficient.
How about this? Should the military be allowed to have those weapons?
Well, they're supposed to be military-made weapons made for the military.
Okay, but should the military be allowed to have things like that? Should any human being be allowed to have these weapons that can wipe out hundreds of people at a time? Or go beyond that? How about bombs, the atom bombs, or even the conventional ones.
I'm in your corner.
Aren't those
on that.
Evil?
I mean, yeah.
Aren't those evil too?
Well, I think what the Truman did in 1945, to me, that was an evil act, because first of all, it was unnecessary, you know, to preemptively drop those two bombs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think using nuclear weapons is an evil thing.
Okay.
You know, I saw a movie. I recommend everybody listening to this should try to get this film. It came out in 1965. I just saw it again, called The Bedford Incident. I don't know if you ever heard of it. 1965 film with Sidney Poitier and Richard Widmark. And it was about 1965 Cold War era, you know, the Cold War. And it was about a Navy destroyer up in the Greenland area, seas. And it was tracking Soviet, submarines and Soviet vessels. But we weren't at war with the Soviets. You know, we were on peaceful conditions with them. And the captain of the ship was a gung-ho. In today's climate, he would be an ultra-right winger. He hated the Russians, hated the communists, and he wanted to wipe them out. And he's in charge of the ship. And he tracks down a Soviet sub that happened to go into Greenland waters. And what cracks me up is, since when does the U.S. have any notion of legality involving Greenland waters? You know, Greenland wasn't, even though Trump wants to buy Greenland, right?
He wants
to buy Greenland. Okay, but he didn't, but the U.S. didn't own Greenland, okay? So the sub goes into Greenland's waters, and that gives this guy the excuse to go after him and track him, and he has a German ex-submarine commander as part of NATO as his as one of his assistants, and the movie shows you. I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but the movie shows you this insanity of this captain. He goes after this sub. The sub goes underneath the icebergs and stays down to try to keep away, and something. Anyway, you watch the movie and you'll see how tense it was, how utterly unnecessary the whole thing was. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going to have to check that movie out. I believe I have seen it, but it's been a long time. Another movie that comes to mind with similar themes is Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, or fail-safe.
Or fail-safe, yes. Which yeah. Both, they basically have the same story, but Strange Love is a little wilder or crazier.
Yeah, it's a Stanley Kubrick film. It's a little bit off color, but fail-safe is a heavy movie, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but the point is, evil is evil, Chuck, in my opinion. And I know what you're saying. I know where you're coming from, and you make a lot of sense. But again, you can't just give a pass to people, especially if they consistently have this mindset. In other words, it's part of their way of life. Like that absentee landlord in Ireland. You know, that's what the guy, he didn't give a shit about his tenants. He wanted his money, and he didn't want to do a damn thing to fix their place. You know, when you see such, and it happens all the time, right here, you know, all over.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so to me, he's an evil man. He's an evil greed. He's greedy.
Okay. I think perhaps what I'm thinking is that the acts are evil, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the man is evil. That doesn't mean the man shouldn't be punished for the acts, but it's the acts that are evil.
Well, that's like the guy who... Well, okay, you say. I mean, to me, there's a million jokes about that. When the guy gets caught, I can't believe I did that. You know, did I do that? Oh, I can't believe I did that. You know, so I didn't mean to do it. You know,
I can't believe I did that. That one goes back to Judas or Cain, but.
Yeah, I can't. Did I really do that? Oh, I don't know. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
But that's, see, we look, the invasion of Iraq is easy, right? I mean, you can go over that and see the evil. I mean, mm-hmm. when they preemptively attack a country, purposely knowing that the country had posed no threat to us, just to get their agenda. Yeah. Well, what about the media? The media that knew at the time that the information that was being given out wasn't really honest. And they kept their mouth shut, and then they cheerleaded. How about the ones who cheerleaded? You know, so Lester Holt was a cheerleader on MSNBC, and then he got himself a nice job promotion and became an anchor.
Yeah, right.
Okay, Katie Couric was walking through
the studios of NBC,
and she was yelling, Marines rock, after we invaded Iraq. So, you know, and she didn't get taken off the air. She probably got a promotion.
Yeah, probably, and a bonus.
Yeah, so that's my point.
It's pretty crazy. All right, well, I'm not contesting the point exactly, just making us, you know, think about it.
Yeah, well, that's
Philip,
what we're here for.
Thank you. Exactly. And Philip, we have used up our time. Thank you so much for being my co-host on this segment every week. I really appreciate it. And
Chuck, just remember,
talking to you again.
Just remember, the devil made me do it.
Huh.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Yeah. It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship.
Or be quiet.
Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship.
You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth.
You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Exile Politics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Schneider will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things, and I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, our next guest of the evening is Michael Annis. Michael joins us once a month from Denver, and I'm going to add him in right about now. So, Michael is a publisher, a poet, a musician, a very multi-talented guy, and we're very lucky to have him on the show, and we're going to try to add him in right now. Michael runs Howling Dog Press, a very interesting publishing company.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. You're on the air on the New American Dream radio show.
Well, hi, Chuck. It's good to be back on the New American Dream. Do we have a good connection here?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Well, it's a beautiful autumn evening in Denver, so I thought I'd bring your audience some radical poetry. It's kind of a stimulating backdrop to spice it all up. So I was so moved by your tribute to Sherwood Ross last month, it started me thinking about some of the poets and writers I've published over the last 40 years. In my work at Howling Dog Press, beginning in 1981 with John Laquaitis's Your Daily Ace, I've published several internationally known writers and poets, among them Allen Ginsberg and Diane DePriman, Charles Bukowski and Gregory Corso, William Burroughs, David Ray, Andrei Kadrescu, Oswald Lewinner, Timothy Leary, J. Marvin. I've also published lesser-known ones who are likewise incredibly volatile and politically savvy activists who have also raised their fists speaking truth to power, such as your show's former co-host Mike Palachek, who is a friend of mine. So in December of 1982, I published Ashes Number 5 from my chapbook series. It was a book, really, since it spanned 116 pages, which far exceeds that of an actual chapbook by definition. The title of the book, or of the chapbook, was Northeast of Globeville in Seasons Once Removed by the Denver poet Frank Winters, who passed away this last year. Tonight will be a tribute to Frank and some of his writing. Globeville is an area of Denver where immigrants from Eastern Europe settled. Frank was a fixture at Denver poetry events. He counted among his friends and acquaintances many who were internationally known in the arts, the sculptors Mark de Souvereau and Marisol Escobar, the musicians, composers Philip Glass and Steve Reich. He acted actually as a roadie for Philip Glass at one point in time. The poets Jack Micheline and Gregory Corso and the photographer Robert D'Alessandro. One time the blues singer Leon Redbone sketched a portrait of Frank while they were sitting together at a bar in Boulder, Colorado. And that portrait appears in the book. Frank's writing had a serious and lasting impact on my own writing. He was influential on several levels, particularly in his style of choosing a word or phrase internal to the poem, whose letters became the letters in succession beginning each line comprising the poem, which is not an easy assignment for any poet. And I've done it myself, and believe me, it takes a lot of work. His artistry spanned multiple disciplines. He was a painter, a sculptor, a prose writer, a tattoo artist, but primarily, first and foremost, a poet, and as a performance poet, had one of the most compelling and engaging styles I've ever encountered. He kept time to his own work by snapping his fingers rhythmically and speaking the lines with an utterly convincing and often loud intensity. He rarely misspoke. His delivery was clean, articulate, and impassioned. Physically, he stood around 6'3" tall, and he had a thick, muscular body that he dressed in black jeans and black leather motorcycle jacket, black engineer boots, and wore a black beret on his head. He had a natural talent for getting himself into compromising situations, which, he told me once, made him feel most alive, digging himself out of danger. He brought me personally into biker gang clubhouses, into tough bars, and into the streets and vacant lots of Globeville, Denver, after midnight, looking for the thrill of encountering something desperate or criminal we might uncover together there. We worked on his book, Northeast of Globeville and Seasons Once Removed, together for over 9 months. His mother was Slovenian, and much of the book focuses on the perilous struggles of Slovenian immigrants in Globeville, where he grew up. The time period would be the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. He theorized that the area's major employer, the smelter that loomed at the top of one of the hills there, where many of the Slovenians had no option but to be employed, was responsible for the highest cancer rate in the entire state of Colorado. He said that when it rained, the mud from the base of the smelter would flow down the hill and right into the interiors of some of the houses that were located below. 20 years before that became an environmental issue, indeed linked to the cancer rate, he was a whistleblower, but could not get any of the politicians to research his claims. They all turned a deaf ear and scoffed at his wild ideas and his wild looks and his wild mannerisms. Northeast of Globeville's subject matter uses the smelter as locus for his literary accusations and challenges to the status quo. The smelter became metaphysically allegorical to him, brooding down godlike on the Eastern European immigrants. It loomed over them, chiding them, cruel, merciless, monstrous through the book, much like the Nazis who occupied Slovenia in World War II. The smelter enslaved them for a time, breaking their backs and throwing their dreams into bondage, but not breaking their spirits. So now I will read a few selections from the book. First, the poem America, once again where each line begins with a letter sequentially from the word America, like Kafka, spelled with a K and not a C. Take me a minute to find it. America. Angry fists assail the lone traveler in Iran. Machine guns force the poet to obey Asian rules. Errant martial law in Pakistan hounds the artist. Returning home, tears filled his eyes, seeing his flag. Inward joy of being free to move without fear. Kansas plains with their wind-mowed fields of wheat. America is home to poets, patriots, and guerrillas. Metric fix on the rickshaw thaw of Denver mines. Equestrian statues fill the lawns of the Capitol. Reacting blindly to the sculpture the constructivists worked, industrial structures dominate the blue skies. Kinetically, these abstract forms float to jazz, answering the only vision or voice America knows. Armed soldiers killed the children in the streets of Europe. Mangled bodies deposited in an open ditch of flames. Estranged immigrants gather their belongings to leave, recuperating from wounds inflicted by vicious armed horsemen. Immigrants for America land to begin their lives anew, kicking their way free of tyranny from against the wall. Angry laborers from Europe that died in an industrial hell. Machines of industry that open deep wounds with a clanging bell. Eternity possesses your estranged lives in the din of dives. Repressed workers arise like swarming bees to the dingy hives. Immigrants from tyrannical hells rose again to the labor call, knocking on freedom's door with pick and shovel in hellish mines, attempting the dream to be full citizens below the stifling smelter, migrating from the tyranny of Europe to another homeland. Enamored with its plenitude and its freedom, they stayed. Resurrection of the poor, oppressed peasant to nobler heights, immigrants who struggled and sacrificed all for a new future. Killing themselves with hard labor, they pass the torch. Annihilated immigrants from distant Europe arise again. Multiple heartstrings of your martyrdom must be heard. Elevate the heart and mind on the steel spine of poetry. Resurrection of the sweat and blood to towering heights. Immigrant of hard-labored creation shall fully rejoice. Kindest moment in the eternal ashes is your resounding voice. Annihilation by the industrial quagmire of forgotten labor, answering your agony with enormous courage and dedication. Masses of martyrs on the flight from tyranny to poverty, enveloped by their hopes and dreams, they ran to be free. Rescued by their strong backs lifting industrial labor. Immigrants who spawned sculptors, poets, pirates, and free men. kindred souls who searched their elemental roots back to Europe. Against the poor mountaintops and repression, this land was bounteous. Miraculous peasants escaped the wars and political upheavals, enticed by the new cities with a hope for opportunities. Riding into Denver to work at the smelter in Retreat Park, immigrant labor was the spine in the back of the industrial hell. Key nerve center of these strong backs resided in Globeville. Anxious immigrants who raised children and grew gardens, meticulous care given to building homes and praying softly, elegant dresses purchased by pain for their daughters to wear. Reverence for Slovenian workers floods the minds of mad poets, indomitable workers who struggled to survive and excel, kindred souls who found the fold of their dreams by faith and virtue, answering Central European tyranny with dreams, blood, and hope, moving across the Atlantic to work the mines on mountain slopes, enlivened by new opportunities, these patriots for a new motherland, reconstructed by the research of successive generations, immigrant workers and laborers who dreamed only America. Kindness in their overworked bones at rest in graveyards, annihilated by the dream that brought them so far. Murder in the streets and no retreats or asylum, entrusting the dream of a future to a distant land. Riding on freighters to a distant shore, they prayed. Immigrant girls, beautiful with prayer books in their hands. Kisses goodbye from loved ones left far behind them. Angelic prayers fill their minds as their dreams unwind. Merciless hours in bottomless mines and smelters of America. Engendering great hopes and virtues into this country, rising above the murder and slaughter they left behind. Immigrants of promise and potential lived out their futile lives. Kindness was their virtue found in prayers and homemade wine. America was their homeland as they smelled the scented vine. Monotonous hours of pouring sweat poisons their souls. Energy sapped, they play out their lives in slums, reacting to the painful hours of this tortured existence. Inquiry into that hell leads to complete silence. Kafka's nightmare incarnate northeast of Globeville. Angelic escape from one nest of demons into another hell. America is home to artists, sculptors, and saints. Merits of the madmen shine in the garbage cans, eliciting lifetimes employers twist the shiny screws. Registered voters elect the official fools at the top. Incarnate hate and deception delivers the chosen debate. Kill the pig that tortures your life and soul is heard. America is the chosen land on the vast desert sands. Meteoric fall of love against the ashen wall. Eternal smile of the trivial wiles unending. Restored boredom eats the fallen crumbs. Ingratitude was the device of the unfeeling lewd. Kindness shared the never-ending Ferris wheel spin. Angered by the poverty and the inevitable death, maniacs fight the police in the streets with free words. Entire generations reject neon and the nuclear net of lies. Reacting to the poison and hate cultivated by the liars we elect. Incorrigible derelicts move toward breakneck ends. Knuckled acts of eye spit and sparse chicken shit. American cancer and industrial filth is our fate. Artists freely speak their minds and hearts, making meticulous forms that represent private thoughts. Elusive freedom of the human being is freely voiced, relying on the compassion of the individual to be heard. Innocents everywhere have the constant, immovable dream ahead of them. Kindling freedom in the streets, the poet calls out with an angry voice. Alienated beings walking through the swinging rings, mellow words are silently heard as they pray aloud. Endless smiles of youth fill the canary cage. Remote riders relent to the rolling vote again. Inside their heads, the immigrants feel dead. Kindred souls recline in the blanket folds with wine. Anarchy in the streets against the mine police. Multiple deaths by the system causes absolute despair. enraged by all the rules and all the stupid lies, rebuke the garbage ideas that produce senseless deaths. Icon of the capitalist is the poor eating their dirt. Kindred spirits vomit on the anger they spew. America of immigrant labor and angry poets call, miserable poets that are forced to sink into great despair, elected officials that steal from the people without conscience, kindness and favors are offered only if money is spent. Anarchy breeds by your actions in the ghettos and the slums. Denver, Colorado, 1982. So, Frank Winters was a protest poet, a rabble-rouser, an anarchist who dreamed of poets actually having a legitimate voice in the affairs of American society. He saw himself as a chronicler and a whistleblower. His work recounts in poetry his overland journeys across the Middle East, where he once was pulled out of a vehicle in Afghanistan to be forced onto his knees at the side of the road with his nose pressed in the dirt for over 2 hours. Machine guns were trained on him, and he did not dare move as his tormentors jeered and heckled him, calling him, among other things, an American pig. His book also contains several poems he wrote about his trip to Kathmandu in quotes, to celebrate Buddha's birthday. One poem about this, Patika Ropa Rika, which is Slovenian and translates into English as birds of prey, goes, and let me read it here. Tika Roparika, praying hawks swoop down on the grain-hungry rats running, turning and twisting the falcon in a small circle, ate his prey. Inside a swift aerial loop, the eagle gathered his wings to land. Carouseling parrots outside Muzaffarpur landed on power lines. Angelic wings beating controlled their speed to find his soul in Nepal as he stared at the stone Garuda. Restive wild eagles sunned themselves in the high branches. Osprey flights careened to the meadow to corner their prey. Parrots on telephone wires spread their multicolored wings to fly. Artists on train rides through India saw vultures and buzzards eat the dead. Romantic thoughts filled his mind as the falcon circled overhead. Ingots of gold had been cemented in the holy eagle's wild eyes. Crashing to the ground, he heard the wild flying screech and the battle that ensued between bird of prey and a tiny mouse. It was written in the style of each line beginning with letters, sequentially from the Slovenian words. Frank and I collaborated on several artistic and literary projects here in Denver. We put together a reading at Sneak and Deacon's Tattoo Parlor in Commerce City, where behind we cleaned the field and beat down the weeds, and then we moved the gigantic 18-wheeler into the back, and all the poets read from on top of the flatbed, and the only thing the flatbed was carrying were the poets and a very thin, tall microphone stand with a microphone on it. And we actually had, at that reading, there was Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and Peter Orlovsky, among the rest of us who weren't nearly as well known. And there were biker gangs that came in. There were biker gangs that came in all the way from Arizona, believe it or not, and watched, and they had the major newspapers out there to put the whole thing together. Anyway. It was a great evening. And then we also held a huge April Fool's Festival at the Slovenian Gardens on Washington Street, featuring several poets and three very good bands. We had two tattoo artists giving people tattoos, and around 500 people showed up, which was huge for nearly any poetry event at that time. And we attempted to integrate the art of poetry in every facet of life we could think of and in every manner and every way we could. We organized and held a weekend-long nonstop reading of the works of John Fante, the Denver novelist who wrote Ask the Dust, Dreams from Bunker Hill, and The Brotherhood of the Grape, After Fonte died from diabetes, Frank went to see his widow, Joyce, who gave Frank an unpublished, unproduced screenplay that Fonte had written. Charles Bukowski was at Fonte's funeral and made the comment that he considered Fonte to be America's best writer. Fonte wrote about the struggles of the Italian immigrants to Denver's West Side. Together, in the course of bringing the book full circle, Frank and I also erected large concrete monoliths on the land once belonging to the smelter. Each of the monoliths had written upon it in black charcoal paint, like an old tombstone, the name of one of the Slovenian poets who had been freedom fighters against the Nazis in World War II. Photographs of that sculptural assemblage appeared in the book, along with a photograph of the dilapidated smelter. The section of poetry is called Sacred Madonna Smile, from which I will read the opening words now, followed by a poem about Tito, who became a hero to Frank. Sacred Madonna's Smile, which is in Posvesenno Spomino, sacred to the memory of the following writers. And he lists well over a dozen of these writers, and each one of them did get a concrete monolith. The following poems have been written in homage of their courage and dedication to their countrymen, that their names shall not be forgotten. All of these poets, sons, poets like their fathers, partisan guerrillas for freedom, death in the battlefields, death in the streets, death in the concentration camps, still life with us, tohitze es nas. So the poet wrote the poem Tovaristo, which translates into English from the Slovenian as comradeship. Tito defeated the Nazi killers from the mountaintops. Onward, the guerrilla fighters marched into battle. Valiant men from Slovenian villages armed to fight fascists, aligned against aggression and terror that had overrun their land. Reports of great victories caused the villagers to celebrate. Integral strategies of comradeship overthrew the invaders. Systematic concepts led to the defeat of the killers in the street. Tito stopped the terror and murderous invaders to his land. Victorious guerrilla soldiers celebrated their victory on the day of the final victory over fascism. They cheered. His mother, Maria Sergak, was his Madonna.
Michael, we're out of time, unfortunately, but this has been a very moving tribute, and I really did not know much about him before this time, so I'm very glad that you did this tribute to Frank Winters, and... hey, I always look forward to having you on the show.
Well, thanks, Chuck. And I know that Frank, if he were still alive, he would thank you too.
All right. All right. Talk to you next month.
Okay. Good night.
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles, a show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreessen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern, Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It just was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back, everyone. Once again, this is the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And it's a listener-supported station. They really do deserve your support. I hope you've been enjoying this. It never ceases to amaze me what a wonderful set of guests that I have on this show, and I certainly thank them. Right now, we're going to have the conclusion of the interview with Deb Cullen-Smith. You know, in addition to all of the personal knowledge that you have, you know, your memories of that time and your love of books and your love of this music from that era, you also did an amazing amount of research. Why don't you tell us some of the highlights, you know, things that you found or sources that you thought were especially good?
Oh, my goodness. The list could go around the block and back. I did find... I did find one book, and it is not right here at my elbow, that was written by the people who actually put Woodstock together, and it was a phenomenal resource. I did find out about the only violent death at Woodstock, I believe the only death, was a young man who wandered into a neighbor's farm. He wandered off of Max Yasgur's farm into a neighboring field and wrapped himself up in his sleeping bag just to get away from the cops and, you know, get just a little bit of peace and quiet, although I don't know how quiet it would have been. I'm sure the music was loud enough to have been heard on the neighbor's farm. At any rate, the next morning, the farmer went out into the field and started plowing up his fields and ran over the young man.
Oh.
And at that point, the army had found out about this, and army doctors volunteered to come to Woodstock and set up a triage for any problems that were going on. And of course, there was a lot of dehydration. There was passing out from hunger. There were some pills. They weren't poison, and they weren't really tampered with. They were just made wrong or made in faulty ways. So a lot of kids were reacting to those drugs. And if anyone listened to the Woodstock weekend that a radio station in Pennsylvania put on, it was a Philly station, but we were able to pick it up by way of the computer. You could hear them talking. I mean, it gave everything. It gave the announcements. It gave all the stuff that went on in between acts. Thunderstorms rolling in. You could hear the whole thing. So it was like being at Woodstock just to listen to that broadcast.
That was wonderful.
That was amazing, wasn't it?
They
put out a lot of messages about, you know, these are not bad drugs. They're not poison. They just were made incorrectly. If you're handed this color of pill, don't take them. That was some of the stuff that I found out. I am disabled, so I don't get around really, really well. I was not able to go down into the Del Mar Loop, which figured prominently in book one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's over in St. Louis. I did all my research for that online. I found the restaurants that are over there. I found their menus. Descriptions of everything. I have been to the Spaghetti Factory, and that was another one that they went to over there. I have been to that one, and it is awesome. But I just researched everything. I researched the hotel that Gary and Victoria went to, the Moonrise Hotel, which is down in the Del Mar Loop. I did all the research about the theaters, the shops, Mulberry Hill, which is a restaurant / music club / novelty shop thing. Just incredible stuff that they have over there. There are stars on the sidewalks, and those are a very eclectic collection of people. Everybody from like Chuck Berry to John Goodman, past, present, future. The people that are on these stars, it's just such an amazing group. But I was careful to make sure that anybody that was on those stars was there in 1992, which is when that part of the story is written. And I had to delete a few. It was kind of surprising. I thought, oh, shoot, I can't use that one. They weren't there in 92. They weren't put on until 93 or 94, and I am a stickler about that. So everything is as accurate as I could possibly make it. You caught one little error. My son-in-law had told me about stinkweed, which is a type of marijuana, but it smells like a skunk. And we had gone to the drive-in one night. We took the kids and went to the a little local drive-in here in my area. And I was asking him about it because he was pretty wild in college, so I figured he was safe to ask some of these questions. And he said, well, you could always use stinkweed. And he started telling me about it. And he said, we'll be there at the drive-in past midnight because it's always a double feature. And he said, you will smell it tonight because they light it up. They start lighting up around 11:30, 12 o'clock. And I'm going, oh, no, you're kidding, right? And he said, no, I'm totally serious. Anytime we have ever gone, you will smell it. And I said, well, give me a nudge or something whenever you smell it so I can take a deep whiff and see if I can at least be able to describe it. So, and he did. Sure enough, around 11:30, 12 o'clock, they were lighting up the stinkweed. And I'm going, that's really a skunk, right? And he's going, nope, that's weed. So we were going to put that in, and you were the one that caught it and said, no, that didn't come about until the early 70s. So I couldn't use it at Woodstock. I had to rewrite this section. That one was hard to do. I wanted to fudge on that so badly, but I really want to maintain that integrity. If I'm writing something about our past, I just feel a real, almost an anal commitment to getting it absolutely correct.
Right.
And so we did.
Well,
we changed that, didn't we?
I think you did a great job of keeping it accurate and keeping it interesting and exciting. I am really proud to be publishing this book. Listeners, you can find it. You can find all three of these books. It's a trilogy. At cwgpress.com. You can also look on Amazon. Search for Deb Cullens Smith.
Deborah.
The Last of the Long-Haired Hippies.
It'll be under Deborah. You better get that full name
right
in there.
Okay, Deborah. Search for Deborah Smith.
Well, no, if you put in Deborah Smith, you're going to get some. You're going to get a romance writer.
Yeah, I know. There's other Deborah Smiths. I know. Look for The Last of the Long-Haired Hippies. Actually, just go to CWG Press. Buy it there.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's the easy way to do it. Shroud of Darkness is book number one. Book number two is Birth of the Storm. And book number three is Victoria's War.
Deb, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me tonight. And I'm sure our listeners appreciated it, too.
Well, thank you so much, Chuck. This was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now for something completely different. We are going to have Julius Abafong, who joins us from Yaoundé, Cameroon. And he recorded his column earlier, and we're going to play that right now.
Hello, Chuck. Good evening. Good evening to our listeners. Today, South Africa is in the limelight with the recent conflict, ongoing conflict between the citizens of some Black African countries and Nigerians in particular against Black South Africans. But the question is, why would Black South Africans, I have to precise Black because it is being carried out by the Blacks, Black South Africans, not the white. Why would Black South Africans go so wild on their own fellow African brothers of the same skin pigmentation, and Nigerians in particular? Most South Africans claim that Nigerians and other citizens from different African countries, different poor African countries, I have to precise that, like Zimbabwe, like Uganda, and so on and so forth, have invaded this country, have invaded South Africa, and have taken over their jobs. That's what Black South Africans claim. But according to Julius Malema, who is the frontline and party leader for the EAF or EFF party, that is a party that's fighting for South Africa's economic freedom, came up with some contrary arguments. According to him, South Africans, the Black South Africans, the act carried out by Black South Africans in chasing away, killing, and the maltreating their fellow black brothers in Zimbabwe makes no sense. The reason they give, like they are taking over their jobs, makes no sense. Because according to him, most companies in South Africa are owned by employees. Are owned by the Chinese, by Europeans, and by the white South Africans. No, I mean, very few Nigerians own companies there. And even if Nigerians own companies, they employ mostly some South Africans, which means they give jobs. And he also goes ahead to say that there are no Zimbabweans in South Africa who owns large farms like the whites do. So the industries are controlled by whites who employ foreigners. I mean, they employ other whites, and their wages with strong wages. When they employ black Africans, the wages are meager. So why will black South Africans be accusing fellow African brothers from Nigeria of stealing their jobs? So he called on the South Africans, on the black South Africans, I want to precise that, to stop glorifying boundaries that separate Africans, because these borders did not exist before the arrival of the white man. I mean, the white man came in with the concept of the modern imported state and divided Africans. And now we are fighting one another in the name of Nigerian, Cameroonian, South African, this or that. So according to him, the bigger image, Africa, should be projected, and not the minority or the micro images of the imported state. But, and this is a black crime, you know, a black on black crime, as Malema put it. So, because again, he has never seen situations where these black South Africans chase away Chinese or any other European. They only do that to black Africans, I mean, to black African brothers, you know. Meanwhile, most Chinese and most Europeans are the ones owning and controlling all the jobs in South Africa. But there are always some contrary views, nevertheless. And this contrary view is put forth by a Nigerian lawyer, a woman, who thinks that what is happening to Nigerians in South Africa is comprehensive, you know, that and according to her, Nigerians living in South Africa have systematically destroyed South Africa morally and culturally. So Nigerians, according to her, should be blamed for what they go through in South Africa. Some of the reasons she put forth are the following. Nigerians who went to South Africa turned South Africa to be one of the major capital cities where drug is being carried out, you know. And most Nigerians in South Africa are fully engaged in this drug business. Because of this, South Africa has been put in a situation where there's constant drug war, you know. People kill people because of drug trafficking and things like that. So Nigerians living in South Africa have, moreover, I mean, with this, they have transformed most South African girls, I mean, girls between the ages of 10 and 14, into prostitutes, you know. And these girls are not only prostitutes, they are highly immersed in drug, and they have become drug addicts, and they are very wild. Their acts of prostitution is very destructive, and this is one of the reasons, or this could be considered one of the reasons why South Africans are so bitter against Nigerians. So this lawyer thinks that if you put on the shoes of the South Africans, that's only when you will feel what they feel, you know. So despite the above reasons and condemnation, I mean, there's been a lot of condemnations on the killings. Some African head of states have condemned the South African government because it has not taken strict measures into controlling how its own citizens venge anger on other African immigrants in South Africa, because this thing started more than 10 years ago. It's seasonal, you know. The Kosovo, they kill people, then it quells down for some time, and the vicious cycle comes up again. But the government of South Africa has never been very serious into resolving this issue, and this time around, people are not taking it lightly. I mean, other African countries are not taking it lightly. Especially when Africa is struggling to come out of a situation where it has seen centuries of slave trade, colonization, post-colonial exploitation, I mean the exploitation of its post-colonial states, diseases like HIV, poverty, and instead of concentrating in fighting out these negative, these ills, Africans should not be killing one another, you know. And this has not only ended there, it has gone up to the point where most South African businesses in Nigeria have been burnt down by angry Nigerian youth who, according to them, are doing this, are burning down South Africans' business, I mean the business business enterprises owned by South Africans in Nigeria, because they want the government of South Africa to take its responsibility into protecting foreigners living in South Africa. Now, this is that is the picture. Now, in my approach as a political, as a green shoot or as a greenhorn political scientist, how do I understand this? I always like to pull this from the perception or the analysis of the view of the imported state. The state in which we live in Africa, I mean, most African states are what some people call the hybrid state. It is a confused state. Some people call African state the lame state. It is a cocktail of different cultures. I would say incompatible cultures, because the imported European culture that was used to build African state did not match with the pre-colonial or the cultures or the African indigenous cultures that existed before the arrival of the white man. So when this cocktail, this mixture, this hybrid was put in place, it is some sort of a difficult thing to be to manage by Africans, you know. And that is the reason why there is a lot of difficulties for Africans to come out of this nightmare. Moreover, shifting aside this post-colonial approach into analysis, we could also talk about the behavior of most African leaders. They don't want to, most African leaders like Nigeria, why will most Nigerians flee to survive in South Africa? Because South Africa is a country not built by the black South Africans, I mean economically, but built by the Boers, the Africans, I mean the white people who left Holland, who left Britain to settle into South Africa. They built this country, not the blacks. Even though these whites are in a minority. Now, most Nigerians will go there because it is easier to survive there than to survive in Nigeria. What is it so difficult to survive in Nigeria? It is difficult to survive in Nigeria because the government is not making it possible for its own citizens to thrive, to succeed in Nigeria, because Nigeria is what we call a competitive authoritarian state. Democracy has failed, I mean, just like Cameroon, just like Zimbabwe and most African states. Democracy is not functional in this state. Autocrats have held on power as if it is their private property, what some people call neo-patrimonialism, where they manage what is supposed to serve general interest as their private property. The state has become what belongs to them and their families. They don't view the state as something that belongs to everybody living in that territory called the state. So that is one of the reasons. So we cannot always blame the imported state. We cannot always blame the white man. We have to look into our own mentality, how we Africans manage our own state. We despise our own brothers. I mean, even in the same country. The government of Cameroon will not take care of Cameroonians. The government of Nigeria will not take care of the needs of the grassroots Nigerian. They are greedy. All for themselves, the leaders, the top. The powerful minority takes everything for itself, while the majority suffers. And because of this, we are into what we are today in South Africa, in Cameroon, and most other African countries. Thank you, Choke. Thank you. I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Well, we're almost to the end of another episode of the New American Dream radio show. once again, I want to express my my sadness for the passing of Mike Ringley, Nighthawk, who created this Revolution Radio network station and has guided it up until yesterday when he moved on to another plane. Remember, this is listener-supported radio, and the Revolution Radio family really deserves your support. There are two streams of music that play, or shows, you know, talk shows and some music, that play just about 24/7, and it's really a great bunch of people. So don't forget to head on over freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Show them some love. Could use some right about now. If my words did glow with the gold of sunshine, and my words were played on the harp unstrung, would you hear my voice come through the music? Would you hold it near as it were your own? It's a hand-me-down. The thoughts are broken. Perhaps they're better left unsung. I don't know, don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Ripple in still water. When there is no pebble tossed, nor wind to blow, reach out your hand. If your cup be empty, if your cup is full, may it be again, let it be known. There is a fountain that was not made by the hands of man. There is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. And if you go, no one may follow. That path is for your steps alone. Thank you, everyone, and good night.
Welcome to Revolution Radio, where you, the listeners, are in charge. Here at Revolution Radio, we present 48 broadcast hours of news and information each and every day. Revolution Radio never sleeps. Revolution Radio is worldwide and borderless information. Revolution Radio is also commercial free. Revolution Radio is supported 100% by you, the listeners. And that's why we appeal to you to donate and support this station and its expenses. You can support us in many available options like archive subscriptions, our seed pack selections, or even my woodworking store. And we also even have Revolution Radio's swag at the Revolution Radio Zazzle store, in which you can get t-shirts, coffee cups, even a baby onesie. Or you can just plain donate to the cause. We cannot continue without your support, and your support is what helps pay the bills. So please, if you wish us to continue, please stop by our station support page and drop a dime on us. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
your data safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents, imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank or all the banks.